It really has been the biggest dam removal experiment in modern history.
This is because the idea was that this will actually help the salmon in.
Right. What's happened with suspended sediment in the water has brought the dissolved oxygen level down to zero twice since the dams were removed. Now you see muck and mud, dead fish floating to the banks, crawdads. We see animals trying to crawl out of the water, trying to get out of there because it doesn't support life. I know of people who were very much in favor of dam removal who are now beside themselves because they had no idea that this is what was the outcome was going to be.
My guest today is Theodora Johnson, a sixth-generation rancher from Scott Valley, California. Today, she's here to talk to us about the Klamath Dam Removal Project, which is the largest of its kind. Siskiyou County recently declared a state of emergency over this dam removal. Theodora is going to tell us the impact of this dam removal on the community, on the environment, and the wildlife in the area.
The same department who, now that the dams have been removed, are downplaying the negative effects on the salmon, downplaying it, and would rather nobody talked about it. Their refusal to sign an agreement with the county to say, look, we won't hold agriculture accountable for any harm done to fish in this dam removal process. So the fish are struggling, and they told us agriculture is the one dial we can turn. There's lots of things we can't control, but agriculture, we can turn the dial on you guys. That's what I've been told more than once. You know, you hear of death by a thousand cuts, but this regulation, when it hit, it wasn't another one of those thousand cuts. It was like they were going for cutting the head off.
I'm Siamak Karami. Welcome to California Insider. Theodora, it's great to have you on. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We want to talk to you about the largest dam removal in the history, and it's happening in California, and you happen to live in that area.
Yes.
Some people thought this is going to help the salmon, and they wanted to help the river. We actually talked to the Indians that actually like to do this project, and their idea was to bring the river's life back. Mm-hmm. And this project just happened, and there's been, it hasn't been going well. And you've been in the area. Can you tell us what you have been observing in your community?
Right. Well, I've come to think of it, and it really has been the biggest dam removal experiment in modern history, because nobody really knew how it would go when they did finally breach the dams. And there was a lot of varying opinions on how much sediment was trapped behind the dams. One calculation said 20 million cubic yards of sediment. I think that the Klamath River Renewal Corporation uses 15 million cubic yards as what their estimate. Either way, it's a lot. And so, unfortunately, what happened when the last dam was breached is it unleashed probably somewhere around 7 million cubic yards of sediment into the river, which was expected by the dam removal entities, but I don't think anybody could have imagined how devastating that was going to be, to have that amount of sediment both suspended in the water and also coating the floor of the river, the banks of the river.
How much is that for some of us that don't understand the volume? Is there any way we can imagine?
Say you take 10 million cubic yards of sediment, which would be half of what we estimate is trapped behind the dams. If you took 10 million of it, and you stretched it over 100 miles of river, or imagine a six-lane freeway. If you had a six-lane freeway for 100 miles long, it would be sediment that is 8 feet deep.
Wow.
And the river below the last dam is 192 miles, I think, long. So if all of it stayed settled in the river bottom, that's what you would get. But a lot of it is, of course, staying suspended in the water.
So you're just going circulating down.
And it's making its way to the mouth of the ocean. And I understand that you can see from above, you can see that dirty, polluted water in the ocean emanating out from the mouth of the Klamath. So it's been just a disaster of epic proportions. And I know of people who were very much in favor of dam removal who are now beside themselves because they had no idea that this is what was the outcome was going to be. And we still hear from the Klamath River Renewal Corporation and the agencies such as California Department of Fish and Wildlife, that, well, this was all expected, this is all within the realm of what we knew was possible, and they're, I would say, downplaying what we can all see with our own eyes.
So what do you see with your eyes?
Disaster.
What's happening there?
Well, you see several things. In the footprint of the dams, the reservoirs that used to hold the water behind the dams, now you see muck and mud that is enough to trap. We've had a lot of wildlife dying in the mud trying to get down to the river for a drink of water. Yeah, deer. The Department of Wildlife has had to come and shoot deer that were struggling in the mud and couldn't get out. I mean, it was really heartbreaking for people in the area. But I think way bigger problem than that wildlife, which is sad, is what's happening in the river itself. So below the dams, the water quality, what's happened with suspended sediment in the water, has brought the dissolved oxygen level down to zero twice since the dams were removed, which they cannot deny. You know it's killed whatever was in that area. And so we see dead fish floating to the banks. We see crawdads. We see animals trying to crawl out of the water, trying to get out of there because it doesn't support life. For I think it was a month, the levels of suspended sediment were anywhere between 4 and 30 times what juvenile salmon can survive. And right now, we're having young juvenile salmon trying to use the Klamath River, leave their tributary waters where they were spawned, and use the Klamath River, which is their highway, to get to the ocean, to go mature, and then in several years, they'll come back up to their natal spawning grounds as adults, and they'll spawn and die, and that's the life cycle. So we have these juveniles that should be entering into the Klamath right now, and we have suspended sediment levels. If you look at the United States Geological Survey gauges, which are publicly posted, although you have to know how to go find them, it's not good levels. It's still not good levels for those juveniles. And I'm not saying that I'm 100% certain that they're all going to die, but it's going to be stressful for them. There were some juvenile salmon that we know were killed in the river because a certain number of the Chinook salmon in our Klamath system actually just spawn straight in the Klamath instead of going up into the tributaries and spawning. So we know that there were about 10% of the whole Chinook population for the Klamath watershed had spawned in the Klamath River. And we know that most of those must have died. So there's 10% of your Chinook salmon, which is an important commercially fished salmon that you've heard a lot about in the news recently because of the struggling populations. Also, there's the coho salmon, which is a threatened, under the Endangered Species Act, it's a listed subpopulation of coho salmon. And there would have been a small number of those in the main stem of the Klamath that died as well. But somehow, and if an ordinary citizen had done something like this, we would have been fined and possibly put in jail. I mean, because it's a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act, there's huge fines associated with, even if you put 1 yard of sediment into the river or one of the tributaries, you would be fined large amounts of money. And for years, we've been under regulations as farmers and ranchers in the area that if we accidentally do a take of a coho that accidentally made it into one of our irrigation canals, we're fined thousands of dollars. And here now we have government agencies that are somehow given license to kill them, and it's okay for them to do it. And they're downplaying, they're not even making it public that they're doing it.
So they are not sharing with the public what's happening?
Right. So the Klamath River Renewal Corporation is required to do a certain amount of monitoring.
Is that a state agency or is that a partnership?
They were created as a shell corporation to take on the operating license of the 4 hydroelectric dams with the intention of decommissioning them. So they took the operating license on from PacifiCorp, and then they had to have the states of Oregon and California as co-licensees because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is in charge of issuing this license, they recognized that this was a huge liability that this corporation would be facing if they take the dams out. So they made the states sign on as co-licensees because it's become very clear that the $450 million that was dedicated to this project is nowhere near enough to recover this river or to make the citizens whole that have been affected.
We actually reached out to the Klamath River Renewal Corporation to find out their side of the story. Here's what they told us. They believe that allowing the sediment, which has naturally accumulated by the dams for over 100 years, to flow downstream is beneficial to the recovery of the river. Quote, that the sediment did not pose a significant hazard to people or wildlife outside of temporary dissolved oxygen impacts. They determined that the temporary water quality impact to the river is outweighed by the substantial long-term benefits for water quality, fish, and river communities that the removal of the dams will bring, quote.
You asked about effects of this dam removal and what we're seeing. Another thing we're seeing is homes that have been ruined because they either have had their wells go dry, the homes that were along the beautiful Copco Lake, former Copco Lake, they've had several wells go dry there. There's homes along the river who are testing their own wells at their own expense because of the toxic constituents that have been found in the river, which, by the way, all that testing and publicizing of that testing was done by our county, Siskiyou County, because we weren't getting that information from the dam removal entities. So people were worried they needed to test their wells. So at their own expense, they're testing their wells. And well, it's a little too soon to say, you know, this is a recent event. This just happened in the last couple months. So it could be that their wells are going to be tainted. And who's going to help pay for those, for any replacement wells for them? The other problem for them, a lot of the homes along the river, is that they're in a newly established floodplain now. And here's the problem. There was a mitigation fund set up as part of this project. However, it's been very interesting. I've been talking to people at the county, and they tell me that this mitigation fund, we don't know how much money is in it. They won't say how much money is coming out of it to go to the affected residents. They won't tell the county. And the funding that was offered was paltry compared to what the costs would have been. For example, one individual whose well went dry was offered $5,000 to drill a new well, which wouldn't even come close to touching drilling a new well.
How much would it
be? For that
be?
Home. I think it depends on how deep you have to go. And at Copco Lake now, I think you have to go really deep. It could be $100,000, but I can't say for sure. But it can be very expensive.
And this was done to actually help the salmon, right? This is because the idea was that this
right.
will actually help the salmon. And
right. The idea was that setting the river free would allow salmon to migrate up higher into the watershed to do their spawning. And I think it's true that there's probably a couple miles, there will be a few miles of river that will now be accessible to salmon. However, there were some natural reefs in the river at Copco Dam that would have prevented salmon passage beyond that. So it didn't open up as much river, I think, as some people had hoped, just because of those natural barriers. And then the other concern that we've been voicing for a long time to the agencies is that the Klamath River is naturally a warm river that originates in kind of the volcanic ground up in south central Oregon. And it's also rich in phosphorus. And so those natural conditions create a lot of algae, which also depletes the oxygen. So that's not good conditions for salmon. So what the dams did was they would actually filter that algae and the phosphorus and other constituents that were coming into the water from farming and everything in the upper basin. And the dams also kept the water cold, the water at the bottom of the dams was cool. So there was this never-ending supply of cold water that could go into the river, which is what salmon like. They like cold water, oxygenated water. So I'm just afraid that it's not going to be the silver bullet that people were looking for, because I know the old timers used to call the Klamath the stinking river before the dams were put in, because it would, on a dry year, it would go dry in places in the main stem of the Klamath. So you would have a rotten smell from all the aquatic life that would just dry up. And that was natural. That was the natural condition. So on the other hand, I think it was 1981, since we got the dams put in, the Klamath was named a wild and scenic river. And it's famous. It's been famous for its whitewater rafting and the wildlife and the fishing. It's just become this beautiful river thanks to the dams. And so, not to mention the fact that the dams created enough power to generate, you know, for 70,000 homes. I guess it was enough power for 70,000 homes, which the locals, such as myself, won't be benefiting from anymore. And in fact, we've been paying in our power bills every month. We've been paying to help remove the dams so that our power bills will go up, because then we won't have that hydroelectricity anymore.
You are a farmer, and your farming community, the people that live around that area, you guys had also had to give some of your water allocation to the salmon, right? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, my valley, Scott Valley, is primarily a snowmelt-fed system. So we get snow in the high mountains that run into the Scott River and feed the aquifer as it makes its way to the Klamath and eventually goes to the ocean, of course. So that's our snowpack. In 2020, the same year that the California Department of Fish and Wildlife sent a letter to the State Water Board asking them for emergency regulations for the Scott and Shasta rivers, which are tributaries to the Klamath. And their primary reason was because coho, the threatened coho salmon, they were afraid, because it's such a dry year in 2020, that there was going to be a complete failure of that year's cohort, that year's generation of coho. So they sent this letter in asking for an emergency regulation. Well, later that fall, the coho actually had a great return. In their adult runs that came into the Scott River were the second highest on record. This was before there was any emergency regulations cutting off our water. So the coho proved that they could make it, even in a drought. Nonetheless, the Department of Fish and Wildlife did not back away from their request for this emergency regulation. They kept after it until finally in September of 2021, we had an emergency regulation slapped on us by the State Water Board with support of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And that regulation, right off the bat, turned off everybody's irrigation 100% in our little valley and in our neighboring valley.
All of your irrigation?
Yeah, all of it. Luckily, it was September. Most of our hay is already done growing by then. It did do damage to the pasture where we feed our cows. And luckily, we were able to get through that without it doing too much damage to anyone. So what the regulation did was put a minimum flow that was supposed to be in the river. We need, for the month of January, we need 300 cubic feet per second. For August, we need 30 cubic feet per second, somewhere thereabouts. I might not have the numbers exactly, but there's a table.
So they would test every
there's
month?
A gauge. There's a gauge
that they're
way
testing.
Downriver that's not even in our little valley. That's how they measure success, is how much, if the river is meeting those levels of water, then we're in the clear. If they don't meet those levels, we get curtailed, 100% curtailed. And the only way for us not to get our irrigation water totally cut off is if we join into an agreement that reduces our water use by 30% all year long. So all for the whole growing season, which is about April through October. Almost everybody signed up for this 30% reduction plan. So that cut everybody's income, what they were able to produce on their farms and ranches, by 30%, roughly. And it was an extreme hardship.
Because there's a direct correlation between water and what you can...
Yeah, direct correlation between the water you can use and your production. I mean, you can make yourself more efficient But that usually requires investing in new technology, and we didn't have the time to do that or the money to do that. We were not given any kind of funding to help us out. So people just lost a lot of money. We sold cows. We sold cows to the point where we wondered if we were going to be able to make our ranch payment, because we have a loan out. That's how we bought our little piece of ground to feed our cows on. Ranches in Shasta Valley that neighboring us that did go out of business. People held on in Scott Valley. It was very hard. People were not sleeping at night. The thing is, it continues today. Luckily, that winter, we had a beautiful winter with over 150% snowpack. And in May of 2023, we actually got removed from any kind of drought designation by the U.S. Drought Monitor. And we sent a letter to the governor saying, hey, you need to lift your emergency proclamation. Because this emergency proclamation by the governor is what made this emergency regulation possible. There was no other way for them to do this regulation. They had to skirt our adjudicated water that we had by doing this, getting emergency powers, right? That's how they did this. So we asked the governor to lift this emergency drought proclamation. We got zero response. But the water board realized that they really couldn't readopt another emergency regulation with the way that water year was looking. So they let it expire midway through last summer. But fast forward to today, where we've had another very good winter. We're still under the emergency proclamation. But now the water board has decided to readopt a new emergency regulation. So they've readopted it. Now we're going to be held to the 30% reductions again. But this time they cinched down on it, and they're making us also buy well meters, which can be very expensive to put on your well so that they can track exactly what we're using.
On the 30% water cut for the farmers, we reached out to the state water board to see what's their side of the story. Here's what they told us. They say that farmers have two options: either comply with the regulations or risk not having water. There are two ways to comply, which are to gradually reduce water usage and find a more efficient way to use water. In terms of the 30% reduction, they say, quote, "There's simply not enough information available at this point to adjust percentage reductions." They believe increased water ground monitoring is needed for the board to refine the percentage if this option remains viable for a long-term watershed solution.
So although we haven't been in drought since May of 2023, now their drought emergency regulation is actually getting harsher. It seems very unfair, especially in light of the fact that they're now possibly killing the juvenile salmon that we gave up so much for in 2022. We gave up 30%, presumably, allegedly, to help those salmon. And now they might be going into the Klamath and struggling, maybe dying. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife is not forthcoming about how they think those juveniles are doing. You ask them for information on what's the river looking like, is it suitable for these juvenile salmon, and you don't get answers. And you may have heard about the 800,000...
The salmon that was released,
yeah,
right?
Juvenile
there.
Chinook salmon that were released from the hatchery, that's operated by the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
And it was released into the river at the area of the dam, or was
yes,
it?
Yes, okay. They were released above the Iron Gate, which is now a tunnel, and they all ended up dying when they got into the Klamath, down into the Klamath River. The Fish and Wildlife put out a press release saying that it was because of gas bubble disease. When those fish went through that tunnel, something happened with pressure, and that could well be. The problem is, they claimed in the press release that, well, we know it wasn't water quality. The water quality in the river was suitable. But then they don't go on to explain what suitable means. I can look at the water and tell you it doesn't look good. I can see dead fish floating to the banks and tell you that doesn't look good for these juvenile fish. And I can also look at the U.S. Geological Survey's gauges that are in place right now and see that the suspended sediment level is still triple, at least, what it was before they took the dams out. And the only study that I have on hand that tells us how juvenile salmon can stand up to that kind of water quality. The only study I have seen shows that it's not good. It's either lethal or sublethal. And the sediment levels keep on fluctuating for some reason. They're going way up, spiking in the thousands, and then coming down sometimes to 200, but never going back to the levels that they were before dam removal, which would be under 100.
So you guys have been giving your water away to help the salmon, but apparently with the dam removal, apparently the salmon is in trouble. Right. And are you guys concerned that you may have to give more?
Absolutely. That's why I'm here, because I can see the writing on the wall. Department of Fish and Wildlife and the State Water Board, both of which were involved in permitting the dam removal to happen, they've already asked us to make up for the drought in these recent years. So the fish are struggling, and they told us agriculture is the one dial we can turn. We can't control Mother Nature. We can't control the cycles of the ocean that might be affecting salmon populations. We can't control international fishing or depredation by sea lions at the mouth of the river. There's lots of things we can't control, but agriculture, we can turn the dial on, you guys. That's what I've been told more than once. And I just see this as the next reason for them to turn the dial down on us again. And if we don't publicize what's happening to these fish because of dam removal, then it will have never happened. And when we start looking at the fish counts and the fish counts are down and they're struggling, the fingers of blame will be pointed at agriculture again, like it was during the drought.
Because you guys' assumption is that you guys are taking the water from them.
Too much water, yeah. Ironically, our coho salmon populations in the Scott River watershed have actually been on the increase for the last 20 years, and even more so in the last 10 years. And so they've actually fared these recent drought years very well. They've been very resilient. And we finally did get the agencies to start acknowledging that, because the coho is what they were pointing at, you recall, for their reason for doing this emergency regulation. And we finally said, look at your own data. California Department of Fish and Wildlife data. It shows that these coho in our watershed are doing quite well. And so they finally said, yeah, they're doing pretty well. But the Chinook and the steelhead, they're not doing as well. Well, Chinook salmon have a problem in that they have a smaller migration window. They like to come in the fall when there's a good fall rain and they smell that in the water, they come up. The adults come up into their natal spawning grounds. And in recent years, we've been having fall rains that don't happen until November, December. And so Mother Nature has not been cooperating. So that has made the Chinook migration window very narrow. Now the coho they're more adaptable. They have a wider migration window. So they don't mind waiting until we do get that fall flush, or now what sometimes has been a winter flush in recent years. And they've been doing great. But, you know, the Chinook have this fall timing problem. We actually have UC Davis hydrologists that have been studying our watershed for years, and their models show that even if we had zero irrigation, there are dry years where we wouldn't meet the emergency flow levels, and those Chinook wouldn't come up until there is fall rain. And so unless we find a way to store a lot of water and provide kind of a false fall flush, which I'm not even sure would be a wise idea.
Like a false rain.
A false
rain. Feeling for that.
Right, because if you have artificial water that runs out, then you have invited a bunch of salmon up to get trapped and die because Mother Nature didn't say it was time yet. So I don't know how wise that would be.
So from what you're saying, it seems that if they want to take more water from you guys, it's not really going to help the salmon.
This is kind of the way I organize this in my head. We had the California Department of Fish and Wildlife who promoted dam removal, even though 80% of the population, the local population, voted against it, and the United States Congress voted against it. They still pushed for it, and they eventually got it, claiming it would be good for salmon. Same department also pushed these emergency regulations on the local farming and ranching community, claiming it would help salmon, but providing no evidence that it would actually help salmon. And our hydrologic model actually shows that in dry years, the flows they're asking for can't be achieved. Then we have the same department who, now that the dams have been removed, are downplaying the negative effects on the salmon, downplaying it, and would rather nobody talked about it. And then finally, we have their refusal to sign an agreement with the county to say, look, we won't hold agriculture accountable for any harm done to fish in this dam removal process. The county went to them, Siskiyou County, went to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and said, this project is happening. We know, you know, there's going to be short-term effects, possibly long-term effects, on the salmon populations. We would like your assurance that you're not going to come to our agriculture producers and demand water from them because of to fix the problem that you created with dam removal. And they would not sign such an agreement. They refused to do that.
If they ask for more water from you guys, what will happen to your farming community?
Our farming community won't be there any longer. And so my kids, who are seventh generation to be born in Scott Valley and to be ranching in Scott Valley, will have to go elsewhere. So our little tight-knit community of people who in this agriculture-based farmers and ranchers, it's just going to dry up, and there will be nothing left of that little economy that we have there. It's nothing fancy, but it keeps our little schools alive. It keeps our couple of restaurants, cafes, you know. It keeps a consistent, thriving in its own right community. And we've been hearing from teachers and principals saying, if we lose agriculture here, we're going to have to shut down our schools, our little schools. And the whole place just goes away. I mean, the people that have been there and been, you know, generations worth of connections and family and friends were gone, will be gone. And I also worry that this trend, it's a troubling trend, in my opinion, that we have a lot of small family farms and ranches that are finding it harder and harder to stay in business. And they're either selling out to large corporations who will farm it, or wildlife preserve nonprofits that want to turn it into a wildlife preserve, that type of thing. Or it'll go to the state and become a wildlife preserve that is owned by the state. And what happens to our food production when it's all owned by either large corporations, or all of our food is outsourced? How does that keep us an independent, thriving nation? I think it's a worry for all of us, not just my family, you know, not just the fact that I've lost my culture and my livelihood, my home. I can't live in Scott Valley if I can't make a living there.
Was there a moment you figured out this is happening to you guys, like, and your community? Was there a moment you guys are seeing that this can happen to you guys?
Well, I think it's been sort of like a lobster in the pot, because we have seen with several listings of species under the Endangered Species Act, slowly, first our logging industry went almost away. There's still a little bit of it left, but then when the coho salmon was listed, we all got added regulations on us in the farming community. We had to put fish screens on every diversion. We had to fence off riparian areas, things like that. So we have been getting accustomed to this idea that, you know, these endangered species are going to cost us a lot and possibly trump our livelihoods eventually. But really, things really changed drastically in September of 2021 when the State Water Board came in with that full curtailment of
completely our irrigation. Cut you guys
yes,
off.
Completely cut us off. And then the following year required those 30% reductions. That's when we realized, you know, you hear of death by a thousand cuts. You know, we were having a lot of added costs for different reasons. And you know how it's been with the price of fuel. Fertilizer also did similar triple in costs in recent years. You know, there's been a lot of added costs, but this regulation, when it hit, it wasn't another one of those 1,000 cuts. It was like they were going for cutting the head off. And we could not understand it. We tried to talk to the water board and let them understand that, you know, we can't survive these kinds of cuts for very long. Luckily, the year that we had those 30% cuts, there was good hay prices for the hay farmers that year. Unluckily for people like me, who had cattle to feed, that was made it extra hard because I had high hay prices, less pasture because they turned off my irrigation, and cows don't stop eating just because, you know, you have less feed. So you have to sell them. It's not like you can just decide to put them aside for a while and, you know, well, we'll farm them next year. No, once they're gone, they're gone. And you have to, it takes a long time to rebuild your herd.
So you guys have cut down your usage of water by 30% because you were regulated.
Right.
And you signed agreements. Has it had an impact on the river?
Actually, no. It didn't show a noticeable difference in flows in the river. And also, interestingly, the State Water Board didn't make a big effort of tracking the changes that happened. It almost was as if they just wanted to make sure we cut 30%. And to see the effects of that was an afterthought at best. There wasn't really any data collected on how did it work. Wouldn't you want to know that? If you were making these demands on somebody that are so exorbitant, wouldn't you want to know if they were working? And really, it didn't seem to have worked. We didn't get flows in the river in the fall until the fall rain came, as usual, which is what we expected. In the fall, when the trees and the plants start to shut down, also flows start to come back into the river because all of those plants are using less water. And so things just kind of happened as they normally would have, other than the extreme hardship that we all experienced by giving up 30% of our water. So, talk about frustrating. And they're still doing it. They're going to do it again this year, even though they haven't been able to document that it's worked.
Have you guys done anything about it legally, or any, if you have any legal rights? Because the water is yours, right?
Right. We have explored this idea, of course, because it seems like it's just not legal what's happening. But what we've kind of come to the conclusion, and I've tried to reach out to some different law firms about this emergency regulation, and I think what it comes, and with very little interest from anyone, any of the law firms, I think what it comes down to is that the governor has issued an emergency proclamation. So he has powers under the emergency clause of our state constitution that allow him to override our adjudicated water rights. And the question is now becoming, at what point is this emergency totally unfounded? And there is a question of maybe at some point we can challenge the governor's emergency proclamation, since we haven't been in drought since May of 2023. But then the question arises, do you go up against Governor Newsom in a lawsuit and win? Do you go up against the State Water Board in a lawsuit and win? Especially when you're us little nobodies, you know? We could pass the hat around and try to come up with enough to pay a lawyer for a while until the state appeals, and then we'll have to do it again. And we just don't have that kind of resources. I haven't heard encouragement from any attorney who thinks that you go up against the state like that and win. But at some point, there has to be a point where this emergency becomes so untenable that it could be challenged. I don't know how that will play out. Maybe it's coming. Maybe it's coming. But for now, we decided that the best thing we could try to do is try to just communicate, get our story out to the public and try to have some influence in that way, because what else would we do? If you can't litigate, what else would you do? What would you do? I don't know. I've been trying to figure it out.
You've been trying to be vocal about this. Why are you doing that?
I'm hopeful that we will find sympathy in the public, because our little part of the world, we don't have any political sway. We're not big ag. We don't have big irrigation districts to help defend us, or we don't have enough money to donate to somebody's political campaign and make us matter. All we have is a beautiful community with a story to tell and that we're trying to save. I'm just hoping that that can have enough effect on people that they maybe change the political climate where the governor finally goes, I guess I can't do this to these people any longer. Because I didn't mention this, but it's actually the long-term forecast for us is not looking great because of another reason. There's been a petition for permanent regulations on us, similar to our emergency regulations, only more harsh. There's a petition filed by the Environmental Law Foundation and some other entities that would be the end of us, because the flow levels that they called for in that petition are beyond what we could ever achieve, even on normal water years. They're like pie in the sky numbers that they want. Again, our fish populations have proven they don't need. You know, our coho have been increasing over the last 20 years, even though we've had 20 years of drought off and on. It's been a trend of drought for 20 years.
Do you have a message for our state leaders?
Those of us who live in the Klamath Basin and on these little tributaries like the Scott River, we love it. And the landowners who are farming and ranching there, they want to sustain life there for their families, for wildlife. It's why we live there. It's not because we get big paychecks. The money's not good, you know. But we live there because we love it there. We want to nurture it and take care of it. And we have been trying to make sure to replenish our aquifer. That's been a long-time practice. But in recent years, we recognize that these drought years we've been having, we need to pay special attention to our aquifer. So we've been doing some research projects trying to see how we can do even more recharge, putting water when we have abundant water in the winter, taking it, diverting it onto dormant fields, and allowing it to seep into the aquifer, and then that builds up that reservoir. And ideally, what we're hoping for, that the research will show, is that if we build up that aquifer enough, it'll actually help feed the river, feed flows in the river. So those are the kind of things we want to do. But if we go out of business, we can't do them. And if our farms and ranches get chopped up into subdivisions or little ranchettes, you won't be able to do those recharge projects. And we know it's not good for wildlife. Roads, sidewalks, fences, they're not good for wildlife. We have deer that rely on the open spaces that agriculture provides. We have deer, we have sandhill cranes, we have all kinds of wildlife that are just teeming in our little valley. It's a beautiful place. And we want to stay so that we can keep taking care of it. And I just hope that our leaders will recognize that and help us find projects to store more water. How can we be more efficient with our irrigation systems? We can be more efficient. It sometimes is expensive to do. You know, everybody can improve. But help us. You know, we're here. We're standing here ready and willing to help. And please don't adopt policies that will actually just get rid of us, because I don't think that you're going to like what happens when we're gone. It's not going to be pretty. The lands in Scott Valley, if they are left to be fallowed, the lands are going to be taken over by invasive drought-loving plants, and it'll become a fire hazard. Scott Valley used to be kind of a marshier little valley. And over time, with help from agencies such as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, a lot of that land was leveled, and it's turned into more of a draining system. And maybe we've found out now in recent decades, maybe we're draining, we've made it too drainable. You know, too quickly is the water leaving our watershed. How can we hold some of it back? And so we're looking at projects on how we can bring back some of the old sloughs and the marshes and try to hold on to that water. So the fact that the valley is now more of a drain than it once was, it's not as much of a meandering marsh. That river doesn't meander as much. The fact that that is true means that if we stop irrigating the fields and the pastures that we irrigate now for hay and for cattle feed and a little bit of sheep feed, and then that we will get invasive weeds that just take over. We saw it in 2022 when people fallowed their fields. It got taken over by things like star thistle, Dyer's woad, we call it Marlahan mustard, other really nasty invasives that you don't want. So we need to take care of this place now. We need to manage it.
So can you tell us more about your community?
Sure.
This is a seventh generation farm.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about?
Yeah. My ancestors came from Ireland and started farming for the miners when they came during the gold rush. And so a lot of the families that came to do that are still there. We have our systems of how we, sometimes we trade a pig for, you know, some beef, or we help each other when it's time to work our calves in the spring. We've been doing a lot of that this spring, and all the neighbors get together. It's sort of like what you might imagine a harvest festival to be. People get together to vaccinate and mark calves, and it's really fun. We love doing that together. We have about 4 small towns in Scott Valley. One of them is only about 50 people. The biggest one is probably 700 or 800 people. There are people who live there that aren't involved in agriculture, but I think everybody benefits from, you know, the ripple effect that agriculture is our primary industry in that valley. And people who have come in recent years have come because of its beauty and how much they love the people and the feeling that they get from people there. I actually had I volunteer for my oldest son's second grade class, and I had the kids do a little writing project, Why I Love Scott Valley. And their responses were so sweet. Some of them were new kids, and they said, one little girl said, I love the people here. They're just so nice, and I never want to leave. And then the boys, of course, were all talking about how much they love to go quail hunting and how much they love to go fishing, and, you know, or go hiking to the mountain lakes, or some of the kids talked about how much they love the cows. But at any rate, it was a really sweet little project. And I wish that more people in our hometown and area would stop and think about that. What do I love about this place? Because we need to think that way if we're all going to work together and find ways to save the parts we love. There's things we might need to change, but let's not lose what we love here. And so I just wish everybody would just stop for a minute and do that little writing exercise that I had the second graders do, because I think it would go a long ways towards making us all realize that, you know, we have more in common than we disagree on. We all who live in Scott Valley, we want to have beautiful open space. We want to have safe schools for our kids. You know, we want to have a friendly environment and the beautiful rural lifestyle that we have. And there are people even locally that I think don't understand that what these emergency regulations are going to do is bring an end to the things that they love. But not everybody understands that farming, you can't just turn the dial down and expect us to survive.
Now, for Californians that are not very familiar with the situation. Can you tell us how do you feel? How does it feel to be in your shoes, seeing what you're seeing?
Well, I feel afraid that my kids won't get to stay there as the seventh generation in our little home that has all these many generations of roots. And I think it's important for people to stand up for their homes and to protect the things that they love in their homes.
Theodora, do you have any other thoughts for our audience?
I think we just need to remember where our food comes from and remember that when we have a healthy market that of small independent producers that can bring food to your supermarket, that's where you will have the most secure food supply, affordable food supply. And also, you know, if you take care of your small farmers and ranchers, they'll take care of the resources. And I think maybe people have this idea that, oh, far northern California is still wild and free and beautiful. And I've been hearing about these farmers who are ruining it up there. We should get them out of there. To the contrary, my family's been there since the 1850s, and we have been taking care of the ground in our little valley for as long, and we love it there. We have beautiful, clean water. We have beautiful resources. I invite you to come and see it, but please don't think of us as a problem up there, even though sometimes that has been the messaging from certain entities. It's just not true.
So hopefully Californians would hear your message and then things will change.
I hope so.
Theodora Johnson, rancher from Siskiyou County. It was great to have you on California Insider.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.